This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, French police break up a terror cell in a Paris suburb. National security becomes a key issue in the 2016 U.S. presidential race.
You allow 10,000 people in, 9,999 of them are innocent people fleeing oppression, and one of them is a well-trained ISIS fighter. You've got a huge problem on your hands.
New worries over a possible North Korean missile launch. An American country music star makes some new music. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. French security forces raided a Paris suburb Wednesday, searching for the mastermind behind last Friday's deadly terrorist attacks. At least two suspects were killed during the raid, including a woman who blew herself up, and police made several arrests. Paris prosecutor François Molin says the Islamist militants targeted were a terror unit capable of planning a new attack. He said the raid was called after phone taps and surveillance information led authorities to believe that Abdelhamid Abaoud, the suspected mastermind behind the Paris attacks, might have been in the apartment in Saint-Denis. Abaoud, a Belgian of Moroccan descent, was not among the eight people arrested. VOA's Daniel Scharf is at the scene of the raid and describes what happened to International Edition host Susan Yaki.
There was a huge police and military presence in Saint-Denis. It was a seven-hour standoff that was taking place with suspected militants that were holed up inside an apartment building in Saint-Denis. They had put up tape, and there were police vehicles everywhere blocking off journalists and pedestrians who were in the area. Very large media presence, as you can imagine, just coming a few days after these horrible terrorist attacks that took place in Paris. And, of course, the suspicion was that the mastermind was inside this apartment.
How did the police know to enter this particular area?
Well, from what information has been coming out, it sounds like they were tipped off by local security. We don't know exactly if that means police or anti-terrorism officials, but this is what we're getting so far, that there was a tip-off that something obviously suspicious was going on. And it turns out, of course, that obviously something very much linked to the attacks that took place on Friday was going on in this apartment building, as one of the suspects, a woman, blew herself up with a vest of explosives in a suicide move to avoid being taken into custody.
Is this raid being seen as a successful battle in the continuing war against terrorism?
Well, if we look at the casualties among police, there were a few injuries. One police dog was killed, but there were no other there were no people killed on the side of the authorities. There were two suspects who died and several who were arrested and taken into custody. So, of course, you know, in any situation like this, I'm sure that the police and security forces would rather have arrested all of the suspects and not have anyone have died, as two of the suspects did, so that they can get to the bottom of, you know, how this entire plot was laid out, and to try and find out exactly where the other wanted suspects in the attacks, where they're hiding out, and who else may be involved in helping them in terms of logistics, weapons, and explosives, and so forth.
What is the feeling there in Paris?
In Paris, we're still seeing, you know, 4 days after these attacks, there is still very much a sense of mourning. The city, to some degree, is still a little tense, of course. This seven-hour standoff certainly has heightened people's awareness that this may not yet be over for Paris, that there could be further incidents. The prime minister, very early on, had sent out a warning saying that this was a possibility that there could be, unfortunately, more attacks that could take place in the coming days, weeks, and months. And that has, unfortunately, come to fruition.
VOA's Daniel Scharf in Paris speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. A deprived district of Brussels is at the heart of the investigation into last week's terror attacks in Paris. Belgium has seen more of its nationals leave to fight for the terror group Islamic State than any other country relative to its population. Henry Ridgewell examines Belgium's growing problem of extremism.
The rundown Molenbeek district in central Brussels is a focus of police investigations. Abdelhamid Abaoud, the Belgian national believed to be the mastermind of the Paris attacks, grew up in Molenbeek. Two of the attackers, Brahim Abdeslam, who blew himself up outside a Paris cafe, and his brother Salah, who is being hunted by police, also lived in the district. Claude Moniquet is a Belgian intelligence analyst.
Molenbeek est une commune qui a été longtemps laissée, je dirais presque à l'abandon.
Moniquet says Molenbeek is a commune that has been abandoned. There is a radical fringe, he says, not very large, but real, and it has existed for 20 or 30 years. So people settled in Molenbeek who have become sort of leaders of radical Islam, not only in Belgium, but also in Europe. In 2001, the assassins of Afghanistan's anti-Taliban commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud, had stayed in Molenbeek. One of the main plotters of the 2004 Madrid train bombings lived in the district. In 2014, four people were killed in a gun attack on the Jewish Museum in Brussels. The main suspect had stayed in Molenbeek. And Ayoub El-Kazani, who attempted to carry out a gun attack on a Paris-bound train in August that was foiled by off-duty US servicemen, had stayed in the same neighbourhood. Security analyst Sajan Gohel is with the Asia Pacific Foundation.
Belgium has a huge problem of its nationals getting radicalized. Many have joined as volunteers for ISIS and even Jabhat al-Nusra.
Gohel says terrorists are exploiting Europe's open borders. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The horrific terror attacks in Paris have thrust foreign policy and national security issues to the forefront in a 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on how the presidential contenders from both parties are giving new focus on the threat of terrorism.
Tears shed in the City of Light as Parisians cope with the aftermath of terror attacks that shook the world. The attacks are now a major focus for the U.S. election campaign, including Republican Donald Trump.
And weakness has shown that when you're weak and ineffective, bad stuff does happen.
Like Trump, fellow Republican contenders Marco Rubio and Ben Carson also oppose the president's plan to accept as many as 10,000 refugees from Syria.
You allow 10,000 people in. 9,999 of them are innocent people fleeing oppression, and one of them is a well-trained ISIS fighter. You've got a huge problem on your hands.
I would be very reticent to bring in people who are ideologically opposed to the ideal of America.
But for Democratic contender Bernie Sanders, it's a question of compassion.
And when hundreds of thousands of people have lost everything, have nothing left, but the shirts on their backs, we will not turn our backs on the refugees from Syria and Afghanistan.
The new focus on national security was also evident in the recent Democratic debate, including former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
We have to look at ISIS as the leading threat of an international terror network. It cannot be contained, it must be defeated.
Republican outsiders like Trump and Carson are still leading in the polls. But fresh concerns about terrorism could cause voters to look at more established candidates with experience, says analyst Charlie Cook.
Who is going to be the Republican nominee? Who can win a general election? Who do you want to be the commander-in-chief to deal with all these problems?
Given the scale of the Paris attacks, analysts say national security will dominate the election debate in the weeks ahead. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Following talks in Paris with President François Hollande, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Syria could be weeks away from a big transition. Secretary Kerry said a ceasefire envisioned by the political process agreed to by diplomats meeting in Vienna last week would help in the fight against Islamic State and draw down the almost five-year conflict. Secretary Kerry said the faster Iran and Russia, who support President Bashar al-Assad, give life to the process, the faster the violence can be reduced. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas told International Auditions Victor Beatty that Mr. Kerry's hope for a timeline is unrealistic, given the unresolved task of determining who will represent the opposition.
I think he means that there will be a convening of representatives from the Syrian government as well as opposition groups. But the question has always been, which opposition groups? The country of Jordan has been tasked with trying to determine which of the opposition groups are acceptable to the West and to Russia and to all of those in the group that is meeting in Vienna. This is a tremendously difficult task. And I think the larger question is, will the U.S. and some of the West lower the bar in terms of an opposition group being at the table in negotiations with the Syrian government? And by this, I mean certain groups like Ahrar al-Sham and Jaish al-Fatah, or the Army of Conquest, and the Free Syria Fighters, who, according to many, including myself, are in many ways no different than Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, who are, according to the principles laid out by the Vienna meeting on October 30th and reinforced by the meeting this past weekend, are unacceptable and should be excluded. So there's still a lot of bargaining and horse trading to be done in terms of who is acceptable from the Syrian opposition. And of course, there's the Syrian government. Who will they accept and their supporters in Russia and Iran in terms of a viable Syrian opposition? So I think it is, frankly, wishful thinking that something of note will happen in the next few weeks regarding a political settlement with regard to Syria.
Russia on Tuesday said that it stepped up its airstrikes against Islamist militants in Syria with long-range bombers and cruise missiles after the Kremlin said it wanted retribution for those responsible for blowing up that Russian airliner now that it's been claimed as having been a terrorist attack. France is also doing the same. Is this an interesting alliance that the Russians and French seem to be forging, with the U.S. now somewhat in the background?
A little bit. And now there's pressure on the Obama administration to step up to meet the level of attacks that the French and the Russians are engaging. The jihadist handbook is to draw in the great powers to begin a fight and bring in the ground troops, because this will be the beginning of an end of times fight that will lead to recruitment and Muslims from all over the world coming into the area to support their cause. This is, in my mind, a convulsive, reflexive reaction when the real problem, I think, long term, is providing governance, providing states that function. This is what led to the creation of ISIS from the very beginning, was the failed state phenomenon in Iraq and Syria. In Syria, I think it's important first to end the war. And I think there's more sentiment to trying to find some sort of political settlement between the government and a critical mass of the opposition. The question there, of course, who is the critical mass of the opposition? That still has not been found, and that is a conundrum.
David Lesh, Syria analyst from Trinity University in Texas, who also says the opposition must be acceptable to the West, its partners, Syria's allies, and Damascus, but does not believe that will happen anytime soon. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Coming up, a Broadway actor makes a splash off stage. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? How about balloon-delivered internet for everyone? At least that's what Google plans for with what they call Project Loon. Project Loon will eventually involve thousands of balloons traveling approximately 20 kilometers above the Earth in the stratosphere. Mike Cassidy leads the project.
To steer one balloon left or right, you actually go up or down. And that's because in the stratosphere, the wind goes slightly different direction at a different altitude. To provide continuous internet service, you're talking a complex choreography where thousands of balloons are being steered and programmed all in an automated fashion.
So soon, hopefully, there'll be thousands of balloons surfing the stratosphere, offering the internet to the more than 4 billion people on the planet without access. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. South Korean military officials say North Korea has declared a no-sail zone off its eastern coast, raising concerns about another missile test. The no-sail zone began last week and is expected to continue through December 7th. In an email to VOA this week, the UN's International Maritime Organization said it's not received any notification from North Korea regarding a no-sail declaration. Victor Cha advised President George W. Bush as the Director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council. He is currently at Georgetown University and is an advisor to CSIS in Washington. He spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about what might be the best response from the West to a North Korean launch.
Well, obviously, before these tests go ahead, the international community needs to do all it can to try to get them to stop, including countries like China and Russia and others that have perhaps better access into North Korea than we in the United States might. And then after these tests, you have to go to the UN Security Council and seek another set of resolutions condemning North Korea and punishing them with sanctions for these actions. But that's sort of all in the short to medium term. In the longer term, what I think is very important in the longer term is that the United States, China, and South Korea need to start having some sort of discussion about how to deal with the future of North Korea. I know this is a very difficult discussion for the three countries to have. I know the Chinese in particular are especially reluctant to have this discussion. But, you know, this is increasingly an unstable status quo. While we have peace right now, the North Korean regime is headed in a direction where things can only become more destabilizing. And that's why I think it's important for the United States and its allies and China to think very seriously about how to respond to deal with potential instability in the country in the future.
As we know, North Korea's regime has failed in so many areas, economically, agriculturally. They have a famine. Human rights is in shambles. But they have succeeded in building a robust nuclear program punctuated by rocket tests that potentially could carry nuclear warheads. What is our best deterrent in dealing with an unpredictable state like this?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the one thing the North Koreans have been successful at doing is developing their weapons programs, and in particular, the ballistic missile program and the nuclear program. They've devoted a disproportionate amount of their resources to this, but clearly this was a national project that has been going on for well over two decades now. Various administrations have tried. U.S. administrations, going back to Reagan, I talk about I chart the path of every administration going back to Ronald Reagan in terms of how they tried to deal with this problem. All of them, I think, with good intent, a willingness to create quid pro quos for the North Koreans giving up their nuclear program, including political relations, economic assistance, energy assistance, food assistance. But every one of them have failed in the end to denuclearize North Korea. So I don't know if there's a good answer here, aside from the hope that at some point this regime, even under its new leadership, is willing to make a big change in their political direction, because it's only a change in their political direction that will lead them to have the political will to give up these programs.
Victor Cha, former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council and now currently at Georgetown University. Time now for our daily look at the world of social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us about a celebrity's comment that got many people talking about race and ethnicity in America. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray.
So who or what are we talking about in this case?
We're talking about actor Taye Diggs. He's best known for his roles in Broadway musicals. And the reason why people are talking about him is because of what he said about his child. He was married to a fellow Broadway actor, Idina Menzel, for about 10 years, and they have a son together. Diggs is African-American and Menzel is white, so that makes their son biracial.
Well, what specifically did he say about their son that's getting him all this buzz?
Well, he said he hopes people will see his son as biracial and not black. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I can see he's certainly calling some attention to himself, and that's not sitting well with some people.
Absolutely. Race in America is a very sensitive issue, and perhaps more sensitive than in other parts of the world because of its history. And this is what he said during an interview with TheGrigo.com. When you call biracial kids black, you risk disrespecting that one half of who they are, and that's my fear. I don't want my son to be in a situation where he calls himself black and everyone thinks he has a black mom and a black dad, but then they see a white mother, they wonder, oh, what's going on?
That's interesting reasoning. Can you tell us about what the public's reaction is online, and where did you go and what did you find out?
Sure. I first went to BET, the Black Entertainment Television's account, on Facebook and Twitter. The Facebook post had only two words with a link to the actual article, and that reads, "Really, Tay? Here's the first comment. But, he's black, sir." Almost 2,000 people liked that comment. Another person wrote a much more scathing and controversial comment, and even more people liked it. So, Ray, as you can tell, most people seem to be against the idea to have his children called mixed.
There must be at least one or two supporters out there for his argument. Is that possible?
Well, surprisingly, not very many. The closest comment I could find online was on the comment section of the actual article on BET.com. It reads like this. Sounds like Tay wants to honor his child's heritage on both sides. However, people base race on appearance. Now, I want to give you an example of my friend who is half Korean, half black, and married to a white person. She told me she agrees with Diggs and that she considers herself Korean and black. And if anyone asks what her children are, she tells people what she is and what their father is. So this segment was not the easiest to research on and talk about, but hopefully this gives an insight into how race can be such a controversial topic, even in such a diverse, inclusive, and progressive country like America. Back to you.
Thanks, G. She tweets from our International Edition account at VOA_IE. And you can also follow G on her own account at G Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Country music star Carrie Underwood has a new hit album out called Storyteller. Here to talk about it is International Edition Sarah Williams with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong.
Ever since winning American Idol in 2005, Carrie Underwood has been making and breaking records. Now, as a new mom with a newly released album, she's making history again. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to explain. What historical first has Carrie Underwood achieved this time?
Oh, man, she's achieved so many. But in addition to her countless awards, including 7 Grammy Awards, 17 Billboard Music Awards, 11 Academy of Country Music Awards, Carrie has an extensive history of number one hits and number one albums, not just reaching number one, but debuting in the top spot. So she just released Storyteller October 23rd. It was the highest selling debut week by a female country artist of this year. It has also made her the only artist in the 51-year history of Billboard's Top Country Albums chart to have all of her 6 albums debut in the number one spot, which is a major historical accomplishment.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, have other female country artists had their albums debut in the number one chart?
Yeah, so you've had Reba McEntire, Loretta Lynn, and Dolly Parton. They've all had, you know, multiple albums, but they were not consecutive. So all of Carrie's albums, 6 to date, have debuted in the number one spot consecutively. If you go back to even Carrie's career, back the very first single of her professional career, Inside Your Heaven, back in 2005, that debuted in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, not the country chart. And she was the first country music artist to ever do so. That album back in 2005, Some Hearts, was the fastest selling debut country album in SoundScan history. It also became the best selling solo female country debut in the Recording Industry Association of American History and the top-selling debut album of any American Idol contestant in the U.S. So that is how her career started, and she has been breaking records ever since.
Well, Carrie's also a new mom now and about to go on tour as well. Busy lady.
Yeah, she's about to go on tour in support of Storyteller. It starts in 2016, and it includes dates in the States, the UK, and thus far, Canada.
How has being a new mom impacted Carrie?
Well, of course, it's greatly enriched her life. She's become more grateful. She actually just recently posted an adorable Instagram video of her asking him for a kiss, and he slobbers all over her, and they're cracking up. It's very sweet. It's gone viral. She plans on taking him with her on tour, Baby Isaiah. And on her CD Storyteller, she also writes a song about him. It is called What I Never Knew I Always Wanted, and it's already sliding up the charts. And it is definitely one of her most personal songs on the CD Storyteller.
You can catch up with Nikki Strong on VOA 1 for Country Hits USA. You can also reach her on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Finally found what I never knew I always wanted. I couldn't see. I was blind till my eyes were open. I didn't know there was a hole. Something missing in my soul.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. More news, information, features, videos, and podcasts, all on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago, Burma's President Thein Sein and the ruling regime launched a series of reforms and relaxed press and internet censorship laws that opened the door to democratization. The government also released from house arrest Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of the main opposition party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD. On November 8th, these reforms were put to their most difficult test yet, as the Burmese people went to the polls to vote in a competitive general election with over 6,000 candidates vying for more than 1,100 parliamentary seats. Election results show the NLD winning over 75% of parliamentary seats nationwide, including enough to control both houses of the legislature. The United States has been very focused on this election, said White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes. It is a critical milestone in evaluating Burma's democratic transition. The United States participated, along with many international monitors, in working to ensure that the election was credible and inclusive, that there was transparency, and that it reflected the will of the people of Burma. 25 years ago, Burma held a similar election, but the sitting government annulled the results. This time, the government has pledged to listen to the will of the people and work to transfer power peacefully. The State Department also recognized structural problems. On November 8th, Secretary Kerry said in a public statement, "While these elections were an important step forward, we recognize that they were far from perfect. There remain important structural and systemic impediments to the realization of full democratic and civilian government." Rhodes summed it up by saying, "We believe this sends a very positive signal that an election took place. The people's voices were heard. The authorities are committing and pledging to respect the results of that election." Huge challenges remain in the country to complete the national reconciliation process with various ethnic groups and to address the humanitarian challenge in Rakhine State, he said. But if they can continue in the spirit of national unity, this is an enormous opportunity for the people of Burma. The United States congratulates the people of Burma on taking this great step toward democracy and commends all of the people and institutions in the country who worked together to hold a peaceful and historic poll that allowed the people's voices to be heard.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.